Accession number 18835, Reel 4.
Jack Davis, Reel 4. What was Sir Edward Elgar like?
Gentleman. Handsome man. Very quiet gentleman. Because, you see, the Langham, as you know, is closely to Queen's Hall when it was in bed, and also with the broadcasting house there. Where was I now?
Yeah, you were saying how you were a signaller in Dublin. Had you been a signaller on the front?
No.
No. This was just when after you'd returned.
When I came back. And
What was your rank in the war?
Well, for a long time, you see, being with Kitchener's army, most of all the appointments were made to the regulars, you know, if you're with a regular battalion. And you're just part of a wide order. It wasn't until I got to the yeomanry that I got my stripes after I'd got the course of instruction. And so, I mean, if you miss out a lot when you take over a certain job, like with the officers of Mercer, being part of headquarters and all that sort of thing. So you don't, with different officers coming and going, you sort of get missed out all that time. It never worried me, I didn't want to.
But you ended up a signaller, did you?
I ended up as an assistant instructor.
That was signals. Would you mind if I asked you more about the Western Front? Yes, because you were there quite a long time, weren't you?
Well, in different places.
In different places as well. You know?
I was there between 15, 16 and 17 at times, you know, different areas. The breaks for when I was sent back to England and backwards and forwards, a bit of a shuttle business.
You were saying about, you described that operation at La Bassée very, very carefully. Can you think of any other memorable occasions wherever you were at the front?
Well, there were so many, you know, that to pinpoint one doesn't seem any more important than another. There were so many incidents happened day by day, you know. Like somebody getting knocked out. There was a certain regimental sergeant who was in my battalion who was on a special mission. He was rather secretive, but he was always missing at night time. Whether he was behind the German lines or not, I don't know. Sergeant Keeling. He was the only man that I know of in the British Army, he was allowed to wear a beard.
Sergeant Keeling?
Keeling, K-E-L-I-N-G.
So he was rather special then?
He was. He was known to be a rather secretive person, but I think he was was more of a socialist. He went to a very good school and all that sort of thing. And he was, one of them was looked up to a great deal for his knowledge. But he was also a bit of a rebel. And he didn't agree with a lot of authority. He wanted to work on his own. So he just got very well in the army, you know.
It was very interesting when you were saying way back at the beginning of the interview about the first flame weapons, the first flame throwers at the Ypres.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Did you see did you ever see them in action yourself?
Well, from a distance, you know, because we were in such a position where we couldn't move out of the trench far enough, just for a spasmodic reconnoitering or a little attack and back going. You see, in one particular area where you're about 600 or 700 yards between, and all that space in between, no man's land, that's where you had to send out reconnoitering patrols to find out various things, you see. And the Germans likewise do the same. So there again, you've got to use posts and forward posts and listening posts. One occasion when we were at a place called, I think, it was known as Saint-Germain. And we were about 600 yards away from the German line. And we had two boys out on the listening post one night when the Germans had a reconnoitering patrol. And one of them got detached from the patrol and got quite near where the listening post was. And wrongly, one of the boys on the post challenged them. And he rushed at him, because they're lying prone. Rushed at him. He got his bayonet away from his rifle and couldn't stand. And the other boy, his name was Newman, I always remember his name, Newman. He grabbed the German's rifle, and as he was going to aim, he shot him. And the German never survived it. But there's one interesting feature. You see, for a long time we used to have a regimental magazine for the benefit of the troops. It was called the Red Feather.
The Red Feather?
Well, for a particular reason, that behind our cap badge, we used to wear a piece of red felt behind the cap badge. You see, all infantry battalions, they had a certain design which was a bugle. And over the top of the bugle was the Duke of Cornwall's, and behind that was the red, make it outstanding. And this incident that I'm telling you now appeared in this magazine there. And it was banned. By the whole magazine was banned by the War Office because they considered it detrimental to the effort because they were afraid it was giving too much information to the Germans. So we never got any more of that magazine article. They stopped it completely. But this incident that I'm saying, telling you about this, appeared in it. I had a record from Bodmin in Cornwall, which is our museum now, with all my records in the 6th Battalion. I've had contact with them from them, a personal, a Christmas card and a birthday card from them, picking out my records. Some people living in Falmouth who had visited it, they got hold of the story, made a record of it and all the rest of it, and gave me a printed record of it. And I was telling them that, and he said, well, there you are, there it is. And he gave me detail, almost detail by detail, of everything that happened. The interesting thing about this, the German that got taken, he never survived after going down to the headquarters. He was so badly wounded with this boy that shot him. And he was wearing a clubfoot. Isn't that surprising? I said to the interviewer that was interviewing me, I said, you know, I can only tell you what I saw when they brought him in. And he said, it's quite true, it is in print. Whether they were short of manpower that they'd recruited, or those that would hold a rifle or not, I don't know. It's so sad, isn't it, because you know very well, under that regime, the master race still exists to a certain extent.
You must have seen some awful things in the war.
Yes. But after your first few experiences, you learn to harden yourself against it, whatever you see.
Were there many bodies lying about?
Several. Mainly in the shell holes that they couldn't get out because of the our boys did used to have remember the Pioneer Corps, they used to do all the dirty work, burying bodies and all that sort of thing, but they couldn't cover every front, so wherever there was any action, there was always bound to be the Germans, because let's face it, they've got a colossal amount of work to do if they're going to bury everybody that they could. All these have been reinterred into the War Graves Commission. So I'm going back a little while. I don't know whether it will interest you. It's the Second World War. I had a godson. He was named after me, Jackie Panther. He was a navigator in a Lancaster bomber that got brought down in Holland in a place called Boykop. About 9 kilometres from Utrecht. The Dutch resistance, there was a schoolmaster, a father, somebody else, and the burgomaster, all members of the Dutch resistance. They got to the bodies before the Germans could. It was occupied Holland in those days, and buried them. somebody made coffins and all that. Everybody had a hand. And a Dutch cemetery, as an ordinary cemetery, just a mound of earth like that. Nothing like our English cemeteries. But right in the corner of this cemetery, they had all headstones of all the names, all turf, flag masts with the Union Jack, and the last post sounded every day. And they're still there, because they had permission from the War Graves Commission to keep them there. 1948, my wife and I went over there to see the graves, and we were guests then of the Dutch resistance. They took us over, and I stayed with the schoolmaster and his wife, who was in charge of all the Russian area. And the other member of the resistance was a farmer, a millionaire in fact, where we could see from our bedroom window at the schoolhouse, which was right next to the school. He'd be out in the fields at 5 o'clock in the morning, working. He's a millionaire. His daughter was a liaison between the occupying forces and the Dutch government. And there were certain privileges I enjoyed, but I was still resisted on the resistance. And we used to watch the children going to school right next door, you know. And the Dutch were still on rations, although we as British visitors were allowed double rations. I used to see all the children line up and hand something to the headmaster every morning. I'm rather inquisitive sort, you know. I wonder what's going on. And I tackled the schoolmaster, our host. And he said, oh, they were bringing eggs for your breakfast, because they were told that an Englishman I always had eggs and bacon for his breakfast. So the kids began to their eggs. Ah, they're wonderful. They are wonderful people. It was only a little village where we were starving. And whenever we were there, everybody's out at their gates, and they got during the cherry season with a flag. It was always when there was cherries available if you wanted to buy the present. And they were kept trying to beckon us to tell us something. And I queried all this, and they said, "Let me just ask you to go in and have a cup of coffee." And the burgomaster, he took us over completely for a whole day, out to lunch and dinner, and took us all over the place. And he had an elderly aunt staying with him. She was 80 odd or something. And whenever you sit down at breakfast table, lunch table, tea table, you always find cheese on the table. Some of them are meal, food, and it's a religion for them, you know. They take hours eating. After we'd all finished our meal and we'd gone into the lounge for coffee or a liqueur or whatever, his 80-year-old was still eating everything. All these sweets, tiny sweets, you just sprinkle all over this. And he was a marvellous man.
Did you ever go back to over your old? Did you ever go back over your old fields of action on the Western Front? Did you return ever?
I'm going over there in next month. In May. Did you know that? The veteran, the 1914 Veterans Association, I'm in touch with the secretary and our president. It's arranged that we go over to Paris, and I think it would be the end of May, to lay a wreath at the Arc de Triomphe. That's in response to this. And from then, we spend the night in Paris, have dinner in Paris, then go on to Ypres, where we're attend in Lowreath at the Menin Gate and the memorial there, and then go into Ypres and a cloth hall where.
Do you remember that in the war, the cloth hall?
I remember it. There's another incident I forgot to tell you. You see, when we moved up from the rush period to go up into action, you go up into Ypres, and there are four companies to our battalion, you see, and we're detailed to take up our post prior to taking over the front line. So there are four positions. There is the cloth hole, cellars of the cloth hole. There are the ramparts. And there is the Sallyport Bridge, another post you've got to occupy. And the reserve trench. Right. Well, it came to us when we moved up, for each company to take up their positions. And there came to be a choice between my company and I was B company. My company and C company, who should occupy the cellars of the cloth hall. And it so happened that C company chose to go in there because they won the toss or whatever was with it. They'd only taken up their position about a few minutes when either some intelligence or spy notified the Germans that British troops were in there. Out at a place called Dicky Bush, that was another one. The Germans had a 15-inch gun mounted on a rail line, which they shunted up in position. Had a direct hit on the cloth hole and buried the whole company in the cellars. Now, we had working party from our battalion, another one from the Somersets, another one from the Durhams, another one from the Devon Somersets and the Durhams. And we lost our second in command. We lost two other officers. And goodness knows how many casualties. Trying to dig them out, because I only had 10 minutes to spare to try and rescue them before the next shell came over. Impossible task, because a lot of the masonry that was brought down, you could imagine with a building like that, half a ton or more when big slabs are coming. So that's what we're going back to. I'm going back to see, because one of my companies were buried. I don't know how many they rescued. So their names will be on the memorial at Menin Gate. And then we're going over to visit the war graves there. All in all, we'll be away 4 days. And Caroline, the lady that showed you, she's coming with me. And my son. She let me know that she would love to go. So I said, "You shall," for being so kind to me. So I'm waiting to hear all the details, probably within a couple of weeks, some of the details, where we're going to stay, what time, how we're going to get. I'm hoping that we go from Ashford right through the tunnel, because I've got to take my chair with me.
Well, I hope that's a wonderful trip for you, Mr. Davis. You'll notice the difference, won't you? Because you described so well that terrible mud when you first went there. That must have made life very difficult, did it?
Very.
How did you manage to live and keep? Could you be clean?
I suppose really, right from the very start, I've suffered so many disappointments and I've come through that, well, I don't let it get me out, let myself get upset about it.
Did you get lice while you were in the trenches? Did you find that you got lice?
One of the worst experiences. And rats.
Tell me about the lice, first of all. Well, what about the lice?
Well, when you're sleeping night and day without taking your clothes off, without a bath, without a wash, and all that, this is bound to happen, you see. And all you did when you got the rest out is try and get rid of them. Burn them out, but you can't do that with material. You see, this is where I am very, very fortunate. I was my company officer's servant for some time. And he came from a well-known family in Cornwall, in Truro. And his family used to supply a lot of comforts and sent them to my officer, who in turn handed them over to me to keep the company supplied. So I clean clothes almost every day, which lightened, but you can't keep clear the whole home, because you're not being kept clean yourself.